Well, welcome back. This is Conversation 10, which is a question and answer session on sexuality. Last time we talked about purity culture.
I think that was quite a new term for many of us, although we may have seen the effects of purity culture. And it's sort of become a thing. So we have explored it a little bit, but I think we may have also muddied the waters and caused some confusion. So we've had some questions, great questions, actually. We're very glad to have had them, and we hope to just expound on them a little bit.
I came across an article I found helpful. It was called Five Purity Culture Myths and Why They Are False Promises. And from the very end, I'd like to read a bit of this, which is a good refresher for what purity culture is. In preaching an ethic for sex that was built on patriarchy, we harm women. We heap undue responsibility and blame on women for men's sexual sin. We promote shame in women and girls for sexual temptations and sexual sins. We engage in victim blaming. We can perpetuate sexual dysfunction and unhappy marriages. And we often shame and silence both men and women if they don't conform to our gendered sexual stereotypes. The author continues, "I don't believe the goal of purity culture is wrong. I believe the virtue of chastity still holds purpose in our church and our culture, but we set ourselves up for shame, disappointment, and disillusionment when we accept the myths, gender stereotypes, and false promises of purity culture. Instead, let's challenge the misogyny and legalism that bolster all toxic theology, and instead seek out a rich, healthy, and biblical ethic for sex." I thought that was well put.
I think it's well put because it's explaining how it's come about, really, and I think we tried to talk about the history of it a little bit before. But right in the beginning, I think for a lot of us, we're going to catch on that term patriarchy.
Oh, yeah.
Because there is patriarchy in the Bible, but I think that maybe you can explain that there's a difference in how we understand and look at patriarchy today, because today it very much is part of stereotyping genders and women's relationships.
Well, patriarchy is all about, it's not just power differentials, it's about disrespect and abuse.
That's today, isn't it?
Right. And it's not that you don't find that in the Bible. In the Bible, that's held up to contempt. It's a violation of God's law.
It's actually a failing of the society, really, wasn't it?
Right. I mean, in most of the world, most of human history has been patriarchal in that men have run things. Right. So we're familiar with that kind of patriarchy. But if you're talking about a patriarchy where men are abusive, disrespectful, that's different. And that is strongly condemned in the Bible.
Right. But what would you define as patriarchy in biblical times? If we go back to Abraham and the covenant that he was under, and what would you... Because that's a patriarchal
what we call,
society.
The patriarchal period, before the monarchy, before the judges, you know, there are various biblical periods of history, but the there was no government as such beyond the family, the clan. You know, eventually you have the tribes, but in the patriarchal period, which is it's the book of Genesis until Israel becomes a nation, and especially before the formation of the tribes, things are handled in-house.
So it really was the term for governance and how communities were going to be run in ancient times.
That's what I'm referring to. I mean, I've known biblical scholars say there's no patriarchy in the Bible. It just depends how you define it. But if patriarchy means that men are better than women, should have more rights than women, should get the first choice, and women are second class, well, then all Christians should be strongly opposed to that. And I know the person who wrote the article I just quoted from is strongly opposed to that.
Okay, but I think it's just one of those terms, it's one of those things that we twitch at, for sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, the feedback we got, and now it's been a few weeks since we did the talk on purity culture, overall, there's been gratitude, and many people agree that, yeah, there's a kind of distortion here. This isn't quite right. Not everyone agreed. Some people are...
But that's really healthy, I think, isn't it? We want different viewpoints, and we welcome them.
Well, we'd be shocked if everyone agreed. Some people are quite invested in purity culture, or if they've had a positive experience. Some of the rules the practices of purity culture they found helpful to them. But at the same time, we've heard a number of parents sharing their regrets about how purity culture has damaged their children in the years they were in youth ministry.
I think purity culture, if it gets becomes legalistic and it becomes rules for living, and then people start to feel that's what it means to be spiritually doing well is abiding by that definition of what is pure or noble or right. That's when people start to get confused, and mm-hmm. then it becomes all about obeying those rules that leaders have perhaps put in place with good intentions, and it's got nothing to do with spirituality and the walk with God.
Right, not directly. Well, actually, that leads in very well to our first question. A brother writes in and says, while I can see how purity culture can be damaging, is this something that really had a hold in our church family? And as I recall in his email, he was saying that he became a Christian in the 80s, and he'd never heard of the term purity culture or a lot of these practices. But, you know, this is a few decades later. There are variations, right?
I think there are variations. I think it depends. This is a huge cultural topic as well. It depends where you live. It depends
what country.
Who oversees your particular family of churches. I mean, some churches are very strict,
right.
And others have... It all depends.
Others should be more strict.
Yeah, maybe so, yes.
But I think overall, and when I replied to this brother, I said, yeah, I understand it's different. It depends where you are, what country you're in, what your experience is. But in general, in our churches, we've considered sexual lust to be far more serious than all the other lusts. And there are lots of different lusts. We looked at 1 John 2 last time.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest ones we see and probably feel the most is consumerism and...
Right, lust for things.
Greed. I mean, just in this Western world today, that's just enormous, the pressure we're under.
You heard people denouncing sexual sin from the pulpit. Materialism, not so much. Occasionally, someone might be disfellowshipped for sexual sin. I've never, ever heard of someone being disfellowshipped for greed, for materialism, although it's hard to see biblically why one would be more serious than the other. And what the thing you take more seriously tends to generate more rules.
Well, I do think, we've mentioned this before, but just the internet has played a huge role in what is permissive and in our society today. And I think that's come in. And so churches have clamped down more and more on sexual purity because there's just this fear, not just in parenting, but in churches, because now pornography, sexual inappropriate comments, it's everywhere.
Right, and that's more flagrant and more alarming in some ways than other internet dangers like shopping and debt and gambling.
But they're just as real, I think.
As human trafficking. You know, I was looking at Revelation 21 today. There are about 30 different lists of sins in the New Testament, and nearly all of them, I think, contain at least one sexual sin. But this is interesting. In Revelation 21, sexual sin is mentioned, but for those who aren't going to make it in the end, you find other sins like cowardice and lying and idolatry and so forth. And so to just focus on one, that's fine if that's the topic of the day, but if that's always the topic of the day, then that's not biblically balanced.
Yeah, and I also think that often we would teach, this is years ago, that typically sexual sin was the first one on the list, and therefore, you know, was interpreted as, well, that therefore it was the biggest one or it was the most important one. But really, when you think about it, idolatry, when you go back to the Old Testament, that is what really grieves God.
Right.
It's just interesting because culture changes things and time changes things as well. And our interpretation.
Some people might think that we're... Well, again, this came in another response. Shouldn't we aim to implement biblical principles? The implication being that PC, a purity culture, is biblical. And because in biblical days, you didn't have dating, and you might even have arranged marriages. How would you start to respond to that one, Vicky?
I think this is one of the most interesting things that we have grown up with in our family of churches, is this whole sense of not just going back to ancient times, but trying to go back to live as the New Testament Christians lived. And it's always just a little bit puzzling. It's like, how can we do that? Whereas I think what God wants is us to take the principles that he's given us and apply them to today, because our world is just such a different place. But the principles still apply, I think.
Right. And there's this assumption when we interpret the Bible that we're supposed to copy first century culture. But that itself is an assumption that I think should be questioned. I mean, are we supposed to wear sandals and greet each other with a holy kiss? We can. We can do both those things, depending on what part of the world. I wouldn't recommend it if you live in the Arctic. Sandals could be a bit painful.
Well, I always think of time when going to Greece and learning about ancient Greek culture, and I think I'm correct that the men used to go and do all the shopping, right? But that wouldn't be very good in our dynamic and our little family here, would it? If you were to do the shopping.
Oh, if I had to go to the shopping, it would be quite interesting. But, you know, when people, yeah, I think whatever your position is on PC, whether you're pro or against or just not sure, probably if you're listening to this conversation, you care about the Bible. You want to implement biblical principles. Let me just make the point that the biblical means the whole Bible. So you can find arranged marriages in the Bible. I don't know how common they were, but one of them that was very successful, a couple who loved each other, were Isaac and Rebekah. It was a completely arranged marriage. Genesis 24, one of my favorite chapters in Genesis. He's never met her before, and they get on famously. On the other hand, you have his son Jacob, who falls in love with Rachel and is willing to work for her for 7 years. I mean, they really love each other. Or you can look at the love, even the erotic love, expressed in the Song of Songs. And so if you pick and choose, what you may think is biblical may not be what the next guy thinks is biblical.
I think, though, for many of us, that's still quite a hard concept in our Western society, that marriages were arranged, even if they were successful. And a lot of it is today, how do we get to know people? But so much as we talked about this, about the wedding, the event itself, rather than understanding that this is something special, bond between you and another person and God, it's sacred. And we've lost a little bit of that, I think, you know, in looking at, we don't want to be labeled as being single sometimes. I mean, that is very, very real in our fellowship, too.
Yeah, this pressure to marry, which we've talked about before, but biblically, marriage is the norm, but it's not a requirement. And if you make it a requirement, or make having children a requirement, then you're ruling out Jesus. So that should tell you right away, you're way off.
But I still hear about it in churches today, and especially when you come to women who are in leadership, that they're often not respected, or they're held back because they're not married and there isn't a place for them. And we still cannot seem to separate identities.
Let's go on to question three here. Are you opposed to PC because it makes Christians seem weird? Maybe you're overreacting. And I think this may come from something I mentioned in the previous conversation about the first kiss. When people involved in PC don't kiss each other until the wedding day or after they're proclaimed man and wife, I mentioned the word embarrassment. I wasn't referring to awkwardness like, oh, the couple don't know how to kiss each other and they're trying to figure out, you know, where are your lips? Oh, I don't know. Where are your, you know, it's not. I was referring rather to the embarrassment of just how odd the practice is when you realize, oh, does this church teach that you can't have any affection, any kiss, until you're married? So just to clarify, I realize I wasn't totally clear, but that's what I meant.
But I also think that what I've seen so often in weddings, it's actually refreshing when you go to a wedding and they don't just talk about sexual purity as the prerequisites for this marriage, because I think it's become all about that. And it's an opportunity to try to preach to younger people or something like that, rather than talking about the creation of a new family and a new family unit and the excitement that's there.
Right.
And so that, I think, has stifled a lot of messages.
Yeah, it's much more than just the sexual side. And loads of people have got married who have held off on kissing until the end, and their marriage fell apart. So it's not like it's a guarantee.
No.
In fact, I think this could easily send the wrong message that affection is wrong. People aren't, singles aren't trustworthy. Until they're actually legally married, then, they really shouldn't spend time together. And, if people want to make those kinds of choices, if you want to say, I'm not going to kiss her, I'm not going to kiss him until the wedding day, that's okay. But to bind it on others...
Or is it to be seen as a position of leadership or spirituality or of like you're doing well spiritually, like it has nothing to do with it. It becomes
it's not a mark of merit, really. And I've heard 1 Timothy 5:2 used in books and talks where Paul says to Timothy that you should treat younger women as sisters with absolute purity. Would you kiss your sister? Would you make out with your sister? Would you go on a date? Well, right, but that's not really the topic of 1 Timothy 5. So absolute purity, yes, but that seems to be saying that it would be impure to kiss someone you weren't married to.
And we're just going back to that purity is not synonymous with sexual purity.
They're
two different concepts. The whole concept of holiness, that's what we're talking about.
So what about purity rings and celibacy vows?
I think from the conversations I've had, a lot of times it's come out of parental fears, from parenting from a fearful point of view. They're worried about their children. I've seen it, I think, with sometimes you've got children, and again, we're talking teens, they're confused, and maybe they think they've got some same-sex attraction, some do, some don't. Mm-hmm. And then the parents are very quick because they feel embarrassed, they don't know how to deal with it. Obviously, there's so much going on in our society today that it's like, well, then you make a vow of celibacy, and then we're going to be okay. Or you take, the girls are interested in the boys, and so, well, we're going to have purity rings, and there you're married, and this is your marriage to God, which ties into some of these books that, romanticizing your relationship with Jesus to be your boyfriend. And
yeah, I would say this has an appearance of wisdom. We ended last time in Colossians 2, the extra rules that are made, they have an appearance of wisdom, but they don't really restrain the flesh. A chastity belt, if those were ever used in the old days, I'm not sure how effective they were, or I'm not sure how effective purity rings are. I mean, I like the idea of being a man or woman of a word, or symbols of an intent to be pure. That sounds great, but it is going beyond the Bible.
And I think it's very young people, and we've got to understand that teens and college students, they're still developing. Their hormones are still from one thing to another. We need to give them space to grow up.
Well, next, are you saying that we should not ask questions of a sexual nature, not hold one another accountable? I can see why someone would think that, because we're critiquing purity culture as being too strict. But no, we're certainly not saying that questions of a sexual nature are off limits, or that there should be no mentoring or accountability. Not at all.
I think probably, whose position is it to ask? Is it from the one who's asking advice, saying we want to have this relationship, or is it a relationship that's imposed as that controls, and the one thing that's focused on, well, were you impure, or did you have a bad thought? How long were you on this date? How late were you out on this date? Because I've seen those things definitely used against people. And sadly, things where young women have come to me questioning their conversion because they were out late on a date, or they spent too long with somebody because the leader was unhappy with them.
It can get strange sometimes. I mean, many years ago, a brother came to me in confidence, and he seemed like he was confessing a rape, but it wasn't. He had had, on a date, he had had a fleeting sexual thought about the woman he was with. And so he said, well, according to Jesus, if it's in your heart that way, you're guilty of adultery. And, so he was just destroyed by that thought. And I appreciated his intent, but for him to tell me and to tell others that he's a rapist because he's had a sexual thought about someone he wasn't married to, that's not right. That's not balanced psychologically, biblically, or anything.
Right.
So we're
and that's then somebody blaming and shaming themselves, and they're just And oh, it's very, very sad when we, again, but that's what culture can do to us sometimes when we just preach about one thing or one-sided things.
Right. So we understand the intentions of purity culture, but some of those side effects, the shame, our identity should be linked to our being in Christ, not to our sexual performance, our sexual purity. It's those narrow conceptions of masculinity and femininity, the guilt and the control, the way that... when.
Well, it's media as well, and it's books as well as films and people...
How do you mean?
Well, because I think books have done a lot to sort of make out the men have to be these macho men, and they want to go and they want to kill animals and they want to go hunting and they want to do this, that and the other.
Oh, like the John Eldridge books. Yeah,
yeah, sometimes. I mean, and again, but...
Yeah, I'm with you there.
But that becomes a definition of masculinity, and not everyone is that way.
No.
But then for the poor guy ends up feeling that they're maybe I'm more feminine then because I, you know.
Well, some women like to go hunting and a lot of men don't, you know.
Yeah.
Like Jacob and Esau, he was out in the fields a lot. He loved to hunt, and I get the impression from Genesis that maybe he never bathed. Whereas Jacob had smooth hands. He liked to be indoors. He was his mother's favorite. They were just very different. It's not that one was wrong and one was right.
No.
So, but we are, these distortions of biblical principles and selective readings of the Bible, these are the things that we're trying to highlight. We've gone through five questions that have come our way. We have five more we're going to go through now in this Q&A on sexuality. And number six is this. Assuming that dating is okay, is single dating biblical?
Is it really even a biblical topic? I mean, again,
well,
this
no,
is just
there's
a
no
cultural
dating in the Bible.
That's true.
There's no dating in the Bible. There's no...
even in a lot of countries, there's no dating. That's an interesting thing.
There's no jet skiing in the Bible either. it's not a primarily biblical matter, but we would need to look at biblical principles. Certainly, it's easier to get to know each other if it's just two of you than if you're in a group of four or six people. On the other hand, I know from, I was a single between the time we got married. Yeah, I'd been, by the time we were married, I was a Christian almost 8 years. So single dates were okay, but I always liked being in groups because it's less pressure. You can't think of something to say, particularly if you're a bit awkward and you're adolescent and, you know, it's just easier when there are more people. But
it is, but then if you actually do like someone and you want to get to know them, being put in a group situation, you know, because like you're not allowed a single date, or it's like, oh, you can't even seem to go out for a coffee, that gets described
as a date. Oh,
what was
that thing you were sharing about Nepal the other day?
Oh, well, yeah, our daughter was there for a little while, and it's like the boys sit on one side of the room and the young ladies, or it's the men almost, on the other side, and it's a cultural thing, and they... But it's like they will let somebody know if they like somebody, and then they're going to work it out for them. So they hardly have any conversation. They really don't go on
dates. So
there's
no single dating.
There's no, definitely no single
dating. But you were sharing
about
the motorcycle.
But then they go everywhere on mopeds, and then they just expect the girls to hop on the back of a moped and cling on to the guy, and because that's a safe way to travel. Now, in America, if you got on the back of somebody's motorbike, I can't imagine how that would be construed or perceived. It would be...
And your arms are around him and...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of a romantic or, you know, almost a sexual thing, whereas...
Well, this is... But so many times these things are just purely functional, but we can make things become sexual that really aren't sexual. You know, when there's this sort of don't touch, don't taste, don't talk.
Right.
You know.
So the question was, assuming dating is okay, is single dating biblical? Well, I think dating is okay generally, depending on the culture. It's not primarily a biblical topic, though. But we need to be wise, and getting advice is good. But don't let people pressure you into dating or pressure you into doing something that's not a biblical mandate.
You know, it's an interesting thing, but I always thought, I think there's a way that young people can get to know each other is just by families integrating, having dinners, doing common events together. So it doesn't put so much pressure on young people to do a single event. And I think if we just had that idea of community and allowed people to be together and have a conversation and go off for a walk, it may be a little bit more healthy, a little bit more normal and relaxed.
That could work. Okay. Should we jump to number 8 and then come back to number 7? Because I think 8 fits well.
Okay.
That was the question. Do women really want to be pursued? And pursued is in scare quotes.
Mm.
What would you say about that, Vicky?
Yeah, this was very interesting because there was a period about five, 10 years ago, I heard a lot of teaching from women saying, women's leaders saying, you know, you need to romanticize and women want to be pursued. And they would even share with the brothers, you know, males, what women wanted in terms of relationship. And I remember a couple of young girls came to me and very sadly, they had been victims of sexual abuse.
Hmm.
And the idea of being pursued by a male, showing interest, texting you, sending you messages or something like that, they were terrified and they just shared with these things. And I just thought, wow, this is another example of us not thinking through, not understanding. And I think this is when we try and have this one standard fits all, into trouble. And so I think we've got to be careful that we don't romanticize dating, even weddings, as we've talked about before, that allow people to build healthy relationships.
Right, and romanticize here, not meaning that there could be no romance, but it's assuming that the way one person looks at things or feels about the situation applies across the board.
Right, yes.
Right. Well, number 7, well, that was number 8, but number 7... what do you think about SA groups? You know, you have AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, there's Overeaters Anonymous, OA, SA groups, Sexual Anonymous. I think 12-step programs can be enormously helpful, but as long as our primary identity is in Christ, so these can be useful programs, but if this is the way you gauge how you're doing, and it's all about, did I look at pornography? Or did I have a wicked thought in my head? And that determines how you feel about yourself. It doesn't matter what other sins you've committed. It doesn't matter what good things you've done or how loving you've been or the fact that God loves you and forgives you. How you're doing and how you feel is pegged uniquely to this one thing. Then I don't think that's good.
Right.
Would you agree with that?
I think that this is... I've seen a lot of people also realize that these groups, you're always saying, you introduce yourself as I'm an overeater or I'm an alcoholic. And that this just self-labeling can also be very destructive because there is got to be a sense that in Christ you're a new creation and you can move on and that doesn't have to be your identity. And that's what we're talking about, I think.
So on one hand, if you have a history of alcoholism, if you say, I'm an alcoholic, I think I know what that means. But if that's your primary identity, not I'm a beloved son or daughter of God, then that's bad.
And that God delights in me. I think that concept has always been very important to me, that in Psalm 18 is that we're created, our Creator delights in us. And so that should be the label, that I am beloved, I'm delighted, I'm His daughter, I'm His son. I'm special. I'm chosen. That's the identity we should have.
I recently finished reading the book of Isaiah and so many passages like that in the end of Isaiah. There are just two more questions here. Quickly, what are the grounds for divorce? So I referred to this in the previous talk. And just to be clear, this is not a talk on divorce. If you want more, I've got a link to a series of talks on marriage, divorce, and remarriage, but I could give you a very quick summary. Based on Exodus 21:3, in the Old Testament, grounds for divorce were, it wasn't just infidelity, but if the husband refused his wife the protection she needed, food, clothing, or conjugal rights, then she was free. And so to these, we would add adultery, of course, and desertion, which is also talked about in 1 Corinthians 7. So in short, you would have four grounds for divorce: material rights, conjugal rights, adultery, desertion, and reneging on one's wedding vows, in a sense, would kind of capture the whole thing. Because if you look at wedding vows people take, they refer to all these things, to have and to hold, to protect, you know, sickness and sorrow and so forth. So there are more grounds for divorce than simply sexual intercourse, adultery, or even that and desertion. And so on that, I simply don't agree with the strictest churches on that topic.
Right, I think our churches have been very confused on this topic, and it is a confusing topic. And again, they want this one size fits all, whereas it's really a case by case situation. And when people just get pegged and they just say, "Oh no, there's been no sexual intercourse," and this is how they define sexual intercourse, which is very narrow.
Yeah, I think that's unbiblical.
We also see women forced to stay in abusive marriages.
Right, because supposedly, say, the fellow, well, he didn't actually sleep with the prostitute, you know, he just watched her, or, you know, but, you know, as far as I see it, he's absolutely gone back on his wedding vows.
Yeah. And again, it's the dynamic, it's destructive, it destroys the women as well as the families. And we've got to see that this is not God's intention for how for respect for one another.
So a few years ago, this was a huge topic, but I completed my study. I put together some talks and eventually notes. And it's 5 audio talks with notes. You can get them at the website, Marriage, Divorce, Remarriage. The link is in the notes to this conversation. If that, I'm sorry, if that affects you, if this is your situation, you've been divorced or you're considering it, but I think it's very important material.
And there was a great book as well that has been very helpful. I've heard from a number of women.
Oh, yeah. And I'll, I've got the link to that particular book by David Enstone Brewer on divorce and remarriage.
Yes.
Well, tenthly, finally, is it realistic for us to hold to the standards of the ancient world? You know, we're more enlightened now. We're more free, liberal. Hasn't our world changed too much?
Well, we are more enlightened in some things, but maybe not other things. The Age of Enlightenment's been going on for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, maybe we're stupider in some ways and wiser in other ways. I mean, you know, in the ancient world, it's not like there wasn't pornography. And I understand. It wasn't electronic. It wasn't instantaneous. But there were things painted on walls. We've seen those.
Just visit any museum and you see very erotic early
and
art.
Not just, but also in literature.
Yep.
There was eroticism there. In the ancient world, for the most part, homosexuality was acceptable. It was certainly acceptable in the Greco-Roman world.
Yep.
So in the pagan world of the first century, that was common. Divorce was common. It was widespread in the time of Jesus in the Roman world. Prostitution was common, and not that many people spoke against it. There was child sex.
There was
trafficking.
Yes, all these things have gone on. I mean, slavery as well. I mean, so many things from ancient times.
So in the ancient world, we're not trying to hold the standards of the ancient world. The ancient world was very messed up, just as messed up as the modern world. We want to be biblical. And I think the word is holiness. Isn't that the operative word?
Yeah, that holiness is this idea of being set apart. And God wants us to be set apart, but that doesn't mean to have strict rules. And I think that sometimes those two things are synonymous, you know.
Right, we should be known, religious people should be known not so much for their rules and thou shalt nots, as for their love. Love for others, love for one another, as Jesus said in John 17.
Grace and kindness, being steadfast in God's love, that's reflected more than a title, perhaps, is the way to
Right, so we need to have, in a way, higher standards than the world. We should have greater respect for each other than people do in the world, that listen to each other more. We're more holy. We care more. Philippians 2.
I think listening to each other, but it's actually taking the time to understand each other. You know, a lot of times we can hear, we can talk, but really valuing somebody.
Well, before we sign off, there are 3 things that are linked here with our notes. One is the article from which I read at the beginning, 5 Purity Culture Myths and Why They Are False Promises. I think you could find that very helpful. Also, there's a link to the series on marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And also, Kanzen, Redeemed Sexuality, a Guide to Sexuality for Christian Singles, Campus Students, Teens, and Parents. So I think that's all we have today. Vicky, is there anything
else
you want to...
Please send in more questions or...
Yeah, we want to hear from you.
Sometimes we misspeak. We understand that. And we'd love to hear other opinions. It's so valuable because that's what leads to conversation and allows us to think out loud, which I think these are what these times are about.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Goodbye. For now.